Buddy's a washed-up hippie turned yuppie.
The things I'd do different if I could do them all over again.
So his son has put him on trial.
It's time to answer for your crimes.
For the sins of his generation.
Now it's time to erase those mistakes.
So out with the old and in with the new.
Growing old can be a painful experience.
On the next Freddy's Nightmares.
Saturdays at midnight on El Paso's Fine Nine.
Hello, my friends, and welcome back to Springwood and our show. Welcome to Prime Time, a Freddy's Nightmares podcast. I am your host, Enrique Couto, here with my co-host, Louie.
Yeah,
Louie, how are you?
Of course you would bring that up.
Bring up what?
That.
You mean that all of our friends are calling you Louie now,
yeah,
just to make you mad?
Yeah, that would be
you
it.
You should wonder what you did that made everybody so excited to jump against you.
I don't even know why it's so irritating to me, but it is.
Oh, because it's not your name.
Well, that, yeah.
Dude, my name is Enrique. Yeah. I have, my whole life has been, hey, Hendrick. Hey, Heinrich. Hey,
It wasn't until you, though, that I got, that I started getting called Dave. Like, not a lot of people called me Dave. Yeah, no, because that was Dad's name. So I was David. I was technically David Jr., even though he never gave me the middle name, Eugene.
Oh, well, for the record, that was never on purpose. I just called you Dave because...
Yeah, no.
Well, I'm sure some of it was like that joke about like, oh, it's Dave. But like...
Yeah.
No, I mean, and that's fair because on Facebook, your dad's name is Dave.
That
and yours
is correct.
Is David.
Yes, it is.
Which makes you seem much more not only French, but Christian.
That is true. Oh, my.
Of the Denoyer Davidians.
God.
So
House of Denoyer.
No, thank you. No, thank you. But yeah, so we got Double D, Louis Denoyer over here. And DLD sounds like a Christian sect, too.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Oh, man. Yeah, you don't want to mess with those DLD people because they've got connections in all of Hollywood, all of politics.
It just gets worse the more you analyze this.
Everything about you does.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, that's just the way it is. So we are breaking in my new studio space right now.
That is true. And it's quite wonderful.
I'm pretty happy with it. It's not done, but it's close.
Yeah.
You can see all the sound foam on the walls.
Yep.
I ran out of foam, which is sad because I was still enjoying stapling gunning things. So, but
I just enjoy seeing the Extreme Justice poster and the Obscurity Volver poster.
Yeah, and the Night of the Scarecrow poster, Haunting of Morella poster right
there.
Your
signed Slumber Party Massacre.
My signed Slumber Party Massacre originals, all of them.
God, that's so cool.
Well, you know, I mean, I refuse to take them down because I have. I would say twice as many posters as could fit in my house.
Yeah.
Minimum. Oh, yeah. And that's that includes like I have 5 Amityville Horror posters in my dining room.
That is true.
So, yeah, usually Double D and I record in my office and it is quite cramped. It could be worse. At least I cleaned the place before we started doing the show.
Yeah.
But now we're in this like space that's meant for
spacious.
It.
Spacious.
I don't know about spacious. I mean, it's a spare bedroom in my suburban home.
I can stretch my legs. I feel quite nice.
Dave's a tall fucker. So, Dave, so how have you been? Does your dog have cancer?
My dog does not have cancer.
Oh, it must be nice. Tell me what that's like.
I'm getting over a cold. I mean, there's that.
Ew.
Yeah.
Take the mic into the yard.
You're broadcasting out there, kid.
I'm just kidding. Don't take the mic.
Yeah. You just go.
Just get out of here. No, I'm doing well. I don't know. Did we? I think the last show I mentioned that we had the scans done on my dog Chicano.
Yeah, you did.
And they're looking good.
Yeah.
So.
And he was very cute when I came over.
Well, he's always very cute.
Well, he's always very cute. But
especially,
I
enjoy making people feel awful because he has
I'm
cancer.
Aware.
Because like. My dog has cancer. It looks like he's in remission,
yeah.
But he does have cancer and he is getting chemotherapy. And if you drop chemotherapy in any situation, people are just immediately like, oh
yeah. Yeah.
So So he's wearing a sweater right now. He's wearing like this kind of Southwest style Christmas sweater.
And adorable.
It's very cute on him.
Yes.
And the reason I bought that for him was when he had his last tumor removed, they're all on his skin. Thank goodness. Mm. But that causes, you know, him to have bald spots and stuff. So last year, I remember everybody was like, oh, his Christmas sweater is so cute. And I was like, it's so he can't get to his incision. And they're like, oh,
yeah.
What from? Cancer.
Cancer.
But no, so his new sweater, people are like, that's so cute. I love his sweater. I'm like, thank you. It's because he has so many bald spots from all the chemotherapy and tests. I just want him to be comfortable.
Yeah.
So anyway, if it makes you feel horrible knowing my dog has cancer, you can help by going to helpchicano.com, H-E-L-P-C-H-I-C-A-N-O, helpchicano.com. We've raised $3,200 so far.
That's awesome.
And I cannot thank everybody enough. And I know what you're thinking. You're like, $3,200. Wow. It's like, yeah, that's almost half.
Yeah.
$8,500 is the total bill.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
As far as it goes right now, yes.
That's if they don't want to do more scans after the last chemo, which I don't think they will. I think they're going to want to wait 6 months.
Well, fingers crossed for that.
The only other thing I want to mention is if you want to support but you don't want to hand over cold hard cash, you can go to Tubi.tv, T-U-B-I.tv, and watch Found Footage, the series, my brand new horror anthology show.
That I'm in. I'm going to add that and every now time. And now
no one's going to watch it. But anyway, I want to get some housekeeping out of the way. I also really wanted, I'm pretty much out of control right now.
Yeah, it's fine.
So I've had a very long couple of weeks. And yeah, did you listen to Monthly Spooky, my other podcast?
I have not yet.
Oh, because that one, literally, it's an hour shorter than normal. And like the moment the show starts, I just go, that's my talk show on Weekly Spooky. I literally on it, I just go, so I'm really miserable and didn't sleep last night and I'm very tired and the show's going to be short. And then I was like, and Michelle's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, wait, I wasn't going to mention any of that. And then the second I hit record, I'm just like, let me spill my guts, kids.
They're turning the freaking frogs.
They're turning the frogs gang. So anyway, but if we get people requesting it,
yeah,
if we get people asking for it,
mm-hmm.
we might even do a show live sometime.
I would love that.
The only problem is Freddie can't appear on screen.
Yeah, he can't.
Because of Warner Media.
That's fair. Yeah, we got to be careful with him.
So that's the thing we have to kind of sort out is like, how do we have Freddie visit us?
We can figure that out. I think we can. I think that's an easy task, I think.
Oh, you think because of all the technical stuff you do
all
on the show?
All the technical stuff that I do on the show. Okay. I think I got this for you. Don't worry.
Thanks, homie. Thanks so much. So anyway, so we're on to season one, episode 21.
That is correct.
This is the second to last episode of the first season of Freddy's Nightmares. And I want to say something.
What's that?
I, having almost watched half mm-hmm. of Freddy's Nightmares, I really like Freddy's
Same.
Nightmares.
Same.
And it's now I'm at a point now where I don't know if the people who hate on it actually hate on it.
Yeah.
Or if they're just saying that they hate it, but they don't really haven't really actually yeah. watched it because it's as fun. I mean, don't get me wrong. I will say it's impressive that a television series by one of the biggest studios in the world at the time.
Yeah.
That it somehow looks cheaper than Tales from the Dark Side.
That is fair.
I don't know how they do that.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's got all the cliches and tropes that I love in anthology TV. And I'm really excited to see what season two is like.
Same. And we may have to discuss in regards of season two, the order we go, because apparently the way they aired is not the way that they're supposed to be watched, because apparently each episode has a sequel. So,
well, we can
tweak that.
Oh, I don't know about all that. We should probably follow the Tubi TV.
I mean, we could easily do that. Yes.
And speaking of Tubi TV, you can watch this episode for free in the United States.
Yes.
On Tubi.tv. If you didn't know that, the link to this specific episode will be in the show notes, as it always is. But this is season one, episode 21.
Yes, sir.
Identity Crisis.
Identity Crisis, indeed.
And this episode is 80s AF.
Oh my God. Yes.
And, strange.
Bitch. That's a bit of an understatement, but we'll get there.
Well, I mean, we probably will. We'll see. So Double D, I guess we should just jump in because I talked a bunch of nonsense for almost 10 minutes straight.
That's fine. Ugh. All right. So we are talking about Identity Crisis. Original air date was May 21st or 22nd, 1989. Now, this episode is directed by David Calloway, who has been the DP on basically every episode so far up to this point. Of course,
David Calloway. That's so weird because Thomas Calloway is a director of photography I know of.
That's
who's funny. DP'd. Like, I mean, he has so many things.
Yeah, he has 41 out of the 44 episodes. And
so the real question is, which ones didn't he
so
DP?
This one and I think two or three in season two.
I would like to talk to Gil Adler because yes. I can't believe that he didn't make him shoot his own episode to save money.
So this episode is also written by Rebecca Pogro. I couldn't find much on her. She did contribute to that show that gets mentioned on here a lot called Dark Justice that a lot of people wrote and starred in.
Okay.
So she did have that writing credit. So we open on a shot of an office where a man sits at his desk drinking alone. Buddy Powers, who is played by Jeff Conway, who, of course, is Kinnicky from Grease in 78. He was also Travis in Elvira, Mistress of the Dark in 88. He was in Jawbreaker, Man on the Moon. He's interrupted by his friend Fred Thomas, who is played by David Kagan, who was Sheriff Garris in Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Jason lives. Yes, he was. And that's the first thought I had when I saw him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, I know that guy. And I'm
this
like,
Tommy Jarvis kid wants us to believe Jason's alive so bad he'll kill people.
And he actually was in 21 Jump Street, Matlock, Angel, Star Trek Enterprise, because, you know, we have to mention all the Star Trek appearances.
Well, Star Trek was one of the, it's like being on a, like, Homicide or whatever.
Yeah,
like, it's just those shows made a lot of episodes and needed a lot of guest stars.
So Fred Thomas is telling him he's headed out to Buddy's birthday party, but yet here he is. Buddy comments that he's not thrilled about turning 40, commenting, "You ever seen a birthday cake with 40 candles on it? It's pretty sad."
Yeah, these guys are so old. 40.
Fred laughs it off and assures him that he's not far behind him and makes a deal with him that if he shows up to Buddy's party, then Buddy will have to show up to his party. Buddy hesitates, but comments that it's not just turning 40 that's got him down. He had a fight with his son, John, and was hoping that he'd show up, but he never did. Fred then tells him that he's got advice for him, stating that they're young, we're old, accept it. Buddy comments he hates to see John throw his life away and that he wishes to himself that he could do the things over again. And Fred reminds him that he can't, and it's his turn now, joking.
You know, these guys are both supposed to be just like 3 or 4 years older than me.
Yeah.
People really looked older back then. Of course, I'm sure they probably were older anyway.
Well, and the amount of aging they do to Conway.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Every time you turn around, he's older than he was older. Before. It's great.
Yeah, so he says, so let him have it, out with the old and with the new, getting Buddy to crack a smile. Fred leaves, telling him that he'll see him at the party, giving Buddy a chance to answer before hesitantly saying, "Yeah, okay." Buddy leaves work, but is stopped at his car by several young thugs who start asking or start telling him that they just want to talk to him.
Yeah, they just want to talk to you.
Surrounding him, one produces a knife and goes to stab Buddy in the gut as he shouts,
yeah,
"No!"
Yeah, it's just a straight stabbing. Straight There's not stabbing. Even reference to give me your wallet, no. Not even reference to stealing his car. Springwood has a phenomenal economy and lots of thrill killers.
And hoodlums, yeah.
Well, because the second episode, the first Beefy Boy episode, well, it's a thrill killer.
Don't forget about the elderly couple that robbed Brad Pitt and
well,
What's-Her-Face.
Those two are a national treasure.
God, that episode was so much fun. So the knife goes in as Buddy grips onto the attacker. He begins sinking to the ground. The screen then turns bright red before going to black, and we hear Fred's voice echo again, "Out with the old, you know." Buddy comes to hysteric in what appears to be an asylum cell with flower power, peace, love, and other hippie aesthetics just painted on the walls of the asylum.
Yes, and and in case you thought it was all a dream, he is still bleeding from his gut.
He is indeed. He looks around and walks over to the cell door where he hears two voices commenting on how this one's tough, but they expected nothing less, and at least he's the last. Buddy brings his hand down to reveal the blood where he was stabbed, covering his hand. Then the voices continue stating their work is almost finished, and one asks the other if he needs help, but the man replies that he's got it. It's his disgrace, and they both state, for the corporation.
For the corporation. And I want to say, sounds to me like these people work for White Castle. I'm telling you right now, they're up to something, and I fucking know it.
You fucking know it? Buddy
They're
begins
turning the freaking frogs gang.
Buddy begins to freak out as footsteps enter the cell, but his focus remains on a small stack of photos of his son John through the years. The guard enters the cell and walks over to Buddy, removing the photos from his hand and throwing them to the ground, commenting, "Who needs sentimentality?" Buddy looks over in fear as the guard states that he must answer for his crimes, specifically his forced values and wasted causes, as well as his hypocrisy. Buddy begs that to the guard that you were just like me. The guard replies that he was like him. He had a disease as he cocks a rifle.
And I just want to say, I had been wondering how many Nazis were in Springwood. So it's about damn time we found out.
That is very true.
The outfits they're wearing, like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, there's no swastikas.
No.
But it's there's a red armband, and there's that I forget what it's called, that like cross that's a cross that like bikers and stuff.
I think a couple of them had berets or something like that. I couldn't tell in the classroom shot we'll get to.
For the record, Dave, you see berets in everything. I think it's genetic. God. From being French.
That's fair. French Canadian, thank you.
You're gonna hurt my buddy the Birdman. You're gonna make him sad.
The guard replies that he was just like him, he had a disease, and cocks his rifle. Buddy questions disease, and the guard comments, "You're old, too old, too afraid to face himself and his family, and that he couldn't even make his own birthday party." Buddy cries that it's them, not him, and he was gonna come to the party.
Yeah.
The guard mocks Buddy, telling him, "Sure, blame the young," commenting that the only good thing he ever did was give life to him, as suddenly the guard points a lamp, revealing the guard to be Buddy's son, John, who is played by Gabriel Jarrett. He was in Real Genius in 1985. He plays Rudy in The Karate Kid 3.
Oh, all right. So yeah. Karate Kid 3 alumni.
He was also in Apollo 13 and The American President as well. So Buddy begs John, but John comments, "Too late, Daddy," and begins to shoot him several times.
Yeah, so the squibs in that scene
in
are...
In this episode.
But... Holy moly.
Oh, yeah.
He just gets lit the fuck up.
Yeah.
And the squibs are so intense, you actually see the fire sparking off of them.
It's so
good. For those who don't know, squibs are a special effects gunshot that makes people look like they're being shot. And it uses explosive charges underneath a blood packet under their clothes, which are cut to make it pop. And traditionally, they're fired with electricity, kind of like basically... You ever set off model rockets when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
You know how you had the thing you turned and it shot it up?
Oh, yeah.
Literally, people who make squibs, like homemade ones, they literally use those igniters.
Well, and I think like one of the most famous cases of a bunch of homemade squibs were King Hodder talked about it on the Devil's Rejects opening when they fucking light the house up. Like that was a bunch of planning that they had to do for that.
Well, and technically squibs can be not on human bodies.
Yeah.
But it's become more colloquial to mean on the human body. Cause you could have like charges in walls and stuff to simulate bullets hitting them and things like that. And the funny thing is, I remember talking to somebody once about that, and they were saying that it was a scene they wanted to shoot. It was like in the woods. And they were like, "Well, what if we just came back later without the crew, just us and the cameras, and we just shot actual bullets at the trees?" And I was like, "Well, the problem with that is it won't look like it does in the movies, because in the movies they're exploding out. They're not actually going in, showing bullets hit things." In fact, do you know how you make how they make sparks? Like when bullets are supposed to hit glass or hit metal, they're like BBs.
Shoot
out of a paintball gun that break and spark.
Oh hell yeah!
Anyway,
okay.
So my point is, these were what I would call overpowered squibs.
100%.
When a squib is overpowered, you see them explode. Like you see a little flash of light because the charge is exploding. And traditionally, they have a piece of metal sheeting on their chest to protect them.
So Buddy gets lit up with the rifle. He starts screaming. And then John and his mother, Dana, who's played by Patricia Eston. She was in Kolchak, Barnaby Jones, Baby Boom. They comment that he's up, while John adds he can't believe he's still having nightmares. So Buddy has woken up from the nightmare that we just saw. He's screaming and his family is sitting at the kitchen table hearing him and commenting on this.
Yeah, they're just like, why does he have so many awful, horrible nightmares? We never hear about anybody else having that problem around here.
So John adds that he never tells him what they're about and he didn't make his party last night. Dana comments he's going through a midlife thing and just for him to just keep up with it and it'll be okay. Buddy comes out to the kitchen, sitting down with John and Dana. Dana offers to go get the paper while Buddy eats. John asks him how he's doing and Buddy comments that he's nervous because today he meets a new boss of his department who transferred from Chemico. John excitedly responds that Chemico is in the Fortune 500 and top architectural firms, adding that, "Buy some stock, Dad." Buddy tells John that that's what's concerning to him. These kids today only think about money, and John has what is probably my favorite line of the episode. He tells him that's not true, and money's only good if it buys fast cars and faster women.
Now, and I'm really enjoying the show. So first of all, I really like that this episode is actually about getting older and being afraid of your own son.
Yeah.
I think that in a way, these episodes have actually gotten smarter and not dumber. Because the thing that you hear from people all the time about the show is that it gets really stupid.
Yeah.
Maybe in season 2, I'll be proven wrong. We're almost there.
Almost there.
But I think that this is actually a pretty cool concept. And the idea that the teenagers in the 80s are money obsessed, while it's the era of the yuppie, which they do get into a little bit later.
Oh my, yes.
But Yeah, these kids these days, they're only concerned with money and 401ks and stability of their future. It's like, okay, I thought they all just wanted to join the goddamn circus like I did.
Or work at Beefy Boy.
Well, for the record, he was going to be an owner of Beefy
that is
Boy.
True. That is true. So Dana brings in the mail, handing John Forbes, Wall Street Journal. She then hands Buddy the Springwood Star Times and Greenpeace Monthly. Going back to John, hands him Money and Finance, and final piece of mail to Buddy, Save the Whales newsletter.
Save the Whales newsletter, and also just Springwood's pegging newsletter.
The Daily Pegger.
The Daily Pegger. Wow, that is impressive. If Springwood has so much pegging that they can do a daily paper about it, even if it's even if it's actually only Monday, Wednesday, Friday,
just a newsletter,
that's still daily.
So Buddy tells John he should stay open to more humanistic issues. John mocks his father, stating just because he doesn't run around in paisley shirts with ban the bomb signs doesn't mean he doesn't love his fellow man, just as long as he doesn't earn more than he does. John tells his mom goodbye and leaves as we see a distressed Buddy sit. The camera then pans over to the kitchen microwave as Freddy appears in the microwave rotating, commenting, Buddy boy's in a bit behind the times, but I'm about to give him a little food for thought. He laughs.
I don't get it.
He laughs as the microwave begins to spark out, blowing Freddy up into a splattery mess.
He just explodes like they were microwaving tomatoes or something. And I want to say, PSA, anybody out there,
yeah,
as a lifelong bachelor, mm-hmm, it's important for me to point out, never microwave your Freddy.
No, don't microwave.
The oven is so much better, and you get that superior crunch,
yeah,
which is completely lost when you microwave your Freddy.
I mean, or if you want to go with the original taste, a furnace.
I mean, who has a furnace, though? I'm just saying.
We'll get there.
Ideally, you'll use like one of those little toaster ovens.
Yeah.
So, and remember, you might be thinking like, well, the packaging only has the microwave instructions now. Google it. Just Google it. I'm trying to help you.
So we cut back to Buddy, who is pouring salsa all over a chef's salad at his desk. Fred pops in commenting, what's wrong with salad dressing? Buddy comments that he likes salsa. It calms him down as Fred comments that he never made it to his own party.
Which is, I like salsa. It calms me down. What is this guy, me? That sounds like a me thing. Like I'd be eating, like you'd come in and I'd be eating a jar of salsa with chips, yeah, and you'd be like, what is up? And I'd be like, I had a bad day. Leave me alone. This helps. Olale.
So Buddy asks, what does he have to celebrate? Reiterating, out with the old, remember? Fred comments, Buddy is laying the self-pity on thick today. And Buddy adds, at least he's doing it in proper social construct and that he's got to deal with the crap motioning to the papers on his desk. Fred comments that the new boss gave Buddy the Coldwater assignment, a banking firm that's about to be erected in the middle of Coldwater Valley.
You said erected.
I did. Buddy states he's getting tired of selling out the ecosystem just to suit more homes. Fred tells him he better take the assignment because the new boss isn't good with no.
And I want to say something.
Yeah.
Good luck fighting business in Springwood. Yeah.
No shit.
Springwood is the most economically powerful and diverse city there is. And a distant second is Dubai.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So Fred tells him, like he said, he better take the assignment. Buddy comments that just what they need, another thumb-sucking, power-hungry yuppie. How old's the little fascist? 12? Unaware that the new boss has just walked in behind him, the boss comments, no, 25, in my office now.
Which is impressive if he's from Springwood that he's made it to 25.
Yeah, no shit.
Good job.
Buddy is next seen in the new boss's office as he tells Buddy for the project, or it tells Buddy that it's his first day. He's going to make a few things clear. Number one, he chose Buddy because he's a good he's good for the project and he's a good architect, and Springwood Bank is their biggest account. Buddy goes to show appreciation, interrupting him to acknowledge he meant no disrespect, but the boss interrupts, telling Buddy if he interrupts him again, he can hike it back to the old folks' home.
He is just now 40.
He adds, got it? Good. Number two. Buddy has to wear a suit to the office from now on. And number three, all personal clutter is to be removed. He closes the meeting telling Buddy to get started on the assignment. What a nice boss.
I like him personally. If he's actually 25 though, then you can butter my ass and call me a biscuit. So, but let's get back to the real purpose
yes.
of this episode, which is the fear of your child being more conservative than you,
oh
which
my.
Was apparently the bane of the 1980s.
Apparently. So back at home,
dig in.
Buddy returns home to find John and a group of friends in the living room sitting in front of a banner that states Springwood Bank in all caps with 3 exclamation points.
I like that there's a group of kids
yeah.
all siding with a bank. Like, I'm amazed he could find 3 people.
No shit. So Buddy asks John, what's all this? And John tells him it's a school project due to some environmentalist burnouts trying to stop the bank from building in the valley. They're starting a movement to push it forward. And who knows, in 3 years, they might be running the bank.
Bitch.
Buddy gives a disgusted look and walks off. Later that night, Buddy gets undressed for bed.
Yeah, he does.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Oh, wait.
There we go. While Dana sits in bed reading, as Buddy comments that his first young poetry-hungry boss ruins the day with the assignment that he comes home to find John pushing the cause forward, Dana tells him not to bring John into it, but Buddy states he's already in it, questioning how could he be so different from us. He continues that he feels like a dinosaur headed to the tar pits with John giving him the final push. My God.
I would love to know if the writer of this was like dealing with getting close to 40, because it has so many great lines about just feeling old as shit.
No shit.
I love it.
So Dana tries to comfort Buddy, reminding him that they were just like John when they were young, and he sounds like their parents when they were trying to rebel, and that he should just try to see it through John's eyes.
Yeah.
Buddy comments that's what he's afraid of as he drifts off to sleep. Buddy awakens to his alarm clock going off the next morning, picking it up and commenting, oh no. He gets out of bed and goes over to his closet, but stops as blood begins to pour from the stab wound, staining his white shirt.
Yes, we're back to that stab wound from the beginning of the episode.
He grips it in pain, but looks down to see that there is nothing there anymore. In the kitchen, John sits at the table in his Nazi soldier attire from the opening, reading a folder. Hey.
At least the kid knows how to shine his own boots.
Reading a folder that says Code Red on it. Buddy walks in asking what he's reading, and John comments, something sad. Buddy asks him again, and John replies, it's a new school project, a classified school project. He gets up as a photo falls from the folder that Buddy picks up, revealing a photo of him that ages right before his eyes. God, that was so weird.
Oh, and poorly done. I mean,
very poorly done.
You know, what are they going to do? They're working on video in 1989.
Yeah. So freaked out, Buddy questions classified. Later, Buddy pulls up in his car to Springwood High, dropping John off. John looks over to his father, stating, "You should have listened. Out with the old." He exits the car, leaving Buddy to ponder those words and asking, "Listen to who?" He looks down to see that John forgot his textbook and goes to take it to him. Buddy walks into the classroom to see all the students dressed exactly like John as their instructor comments, "You're the corporation," before they all turn and stare at Buddy.
That's just how public school works. Everyone think the same now. Think the same. What are you thinking about? No, think the same as the rest of us.
He stutters quietly and nervously says he brought John's book as we cut to John's POV, which has turned his dad into a full-on hippie in his mind, before telling Buddy he doesn't belong here. Buddy sets the book down on the floor and backs out of the room, finding himself suddenly at his office. He panics, trying to get others' attention, but they all continue working as if they don't see him.
Just look at the size of this architecture firm.
Yeah.
Springwood is growing like a goddamn tumor. I mean, how could a small Midwest town need like 18 architects working simultaneously?
He scrambles to Fred's cubicle, finding it piled with boxes. Buddy panically asks, where is Fred Thomas, before stepping onto a piece of severed scalp. Now, this is one thing I forgot to mention. Fred Thomas has a ponytail.
And it's one of those lame ass, like high school art teacher that asks you to take off your shirts and kiss ponytails. And that all being said, I'm a lifelong long hair haver.
Yeah.
So I always make fun of people who have like just enough hair to have a ponytail.
Yeah.
But the symbolism of his ponytail being cut off at the scalp and laying on the floor is pretty epic.
Oh, yeah.
I actually really like that, though.
So he steps on Fred's ponytail. Buddy begins to gag, throwing it back on the floor. Suddenly, he hears screams and runs to a door marked Corrections, banging on it until a young man opens it, revealing a puddle of blood on the floor inside. The man steps through it. and he walks past Buddy, who is going manic. He begins to bang on the door again before the boss grabs him, telling Buddy, come with me, walk with me, talk with me. Buddy is then seated in the boss's office watching as another old man strapped to a gurney is pushed through a bin marked obsolete. God, this episode. Buddy tries to loosen his tie before the boss stops telling him he'll ruin the material and if he keeps messing with it. Buddy asks, what's happening here? And the boss comments that it's already happening. And he's heard of Out with the Old and with the New. Buddy comments it's a popular tune, to which his boss adds, guess which end you're on.
Hey, which one do you think?
I don't know.
I don't get it.
Grinning at him, Buddy asks what happened to Fred and is told he was corrected as a man reveals a cube almost like a carbonite of a screaming Fred. The boss comments that he touches Buddy's stab wound, coming back with blood on his hands, he licks off. Suddenly, two figures appear by Buddy, placing their hands on his shoulder as he looks up in fear. And one thing we forgot to mention so far, we watch these on Tubi, of course. No breaks.
After weeks of the breaks being like a fever dream.
Yeah.
Now none. All of a sudden they were not getting these weird Freddy interruptions that we are having breaks.
The commercials are playing. We're still having those. Yes.
But, and unfortunately none for NyQuil.
No, none for NyQuil.
From this last time, but I guess flu season's over, kids. But,
So later, Buddy returns home in a panic as voices echo outside, clearly looking for him and discussing covering the house and areas around. He ducks down as spotlights bounce onto the windows. Buddy then hears John in the living room with more students in their soldier attire, talking with another man on a walkie-talkie who states that Buddy must be brought in immediately as he's not suitable for reprogramming. John agrees with commenting, it's hopeless, but he knows it's required, and for the corporation. Buddy ducks back into the kitchen, keeping hidden, and begins to mess with his tie again as he begins to call and look for Dana, but no reply or sight of her. Going into the bedroom, he picks up a picture frame, revealing a picture of the three of them, Dana, John, and Buddy, but Dana has now been whited out or cut out of the picture entirely.
So there's no Dana, only Zool?
No Dana, only Zool.
Oh, man.
He looks back again to see he's now cut out of the picture, too. Suddenly, John begins to knock at the bedroom door, commenting that he knows he's in there and tells him to come out and they'll listen to the Grateful Dead mocking him.
Dude, they're roasting this guy so good. I can't pretend that I don't enjoy a little hippie roast every now and then.
Buddy remains still as sounds of the guns cocking begin to go through the door, and John calls out, lose the door.
These kids are all armed with AK-47s.
So lose the door echoes as bullets rip through the door. Buddy then dives out of harm's way onto the bed. John kicks the door in, spraying more bullets as the soldiers grab Buddy, holding him at gunpoint. John walks over to Buddy, telling him his generation made mistakes, and now it's time to erase those mistakes. Now in shades like John, Buddy's boss stands before him as he's told that they're putting him on trial and legal aid has been provided. And goddammit, Buddy sits down to see a man dressed as a hippie who pats him on the shoulder, commenting, wow, man, what a trip. And I really wanted it to be Freddy this time. Just Freddy as the lawyer.
As the lawyer. Yeah. See, I think that Freddy has too high of a morality to be a lawyer. That's the problem.
So the boss asks Buddy that he claims to stand up for something, but when's the last time he donated his talents freely for the sake of an issue? Buddy tells him 1970, adding he doesn't have much time now. Unseen voices begin to laugh and berate Buddy. The boss goes on to ask if he's ever owned or worn a Save the Whales t-shirt. Oh,
and I just want to say, I love that they're roasting him for being a hypocrite, though. Yeah. I really appreciate that, because at the beginning when he was acting like the problem was his son was too conservative, I was like, well, look at you, Mr. Corporate Jobby Job guy. Yeah. Like, what are you talking about? And now they're pointing out, they're like, do you donate your time and money to things? And he's like, I mean, 11 years ago I did.
Buddy comments that he used to, but his wife now uses the shirt to dust clothes. The boss interrupts, telling him the case is closed and he sold out. Unseen voices add, he's out of here and bye-bye, as the hippie attorney tells him, sorry, man.
Sorry, man.
Buddy demands to the boss to know where his wife is, and the boss adds, she's being completed, as a big red sign with black letters spelling out obsolete is placed around Buddy's neck.
Ooh, I wonder where you get big obsolete signs. Probably Amazon.
I would imagine Amazon.
I know what someone's getting for Christmas.
That's terrible. The boss tells Buddy to walk with him, talk with him, again, as Buddy is led down a hallway with bloody footprints all over the floor. He clearly begins to age further as he's taken further down the hallway, and they come to a door with garish pink lighting glowing inside. Buddy then watches as two soldiers force Dana into a guillotine and drop the blade down, decapitating her and sending her head rolling right to his feet.
Yeah, the weapons of murder just keep escalating. Oh, I know. Escalating. Now we're just looking at full-blown friggin' guillotines.
So the head rolls to his feet, and the boss walks over telling Buddy that he's obsolete and that he's abandoned his ideals. The boss reaches up, pulling at his face as a mask gives away, revealing John under it as he tells Buddy, "You failed my test, Daddy. You failed." He orders the guards then to complete him. As they force Buddy into the guillotine, Buddy looks down to see a smiley face in the basket as the blade drops, killing him. The screen goes red again as we come to find Buddy laying down in the parking lot, bleeding from the stab wound earlier in the episode. John suddenly then rushes to his side, asking who did this to him. Buddy apologizes that he tried, but they found him and called him old man. John tells him that he'll get help, and Buddy tells him it's too late, but John runs to a payphone calling 911, returns to Buddy's side, begging him not to die, and apologizes for their fight. Buddy apologizes again, stating, "It's your turn now." John replies, telling Buddy he's sorry and that he loves him. And the A story then ends as we cut to Freddy with his head now resting in the guillotine as he comments, "Growing old can be a painful experience," before he pulls the rope, dropping the blade, and it cuts to black as we hear Freddy's laughter, now, of course.
First of all, that's not even a pun. That's just the truth.
It's just the truth.
That's a sad ending.
It's a really sad ending.
Like, super duper sad.
I was kind of like, I didn't know where this episode was going to go at first, because when they showed the classroom, I was almost expecting like a class of 1984 or even 99 kind of scenario.
Like kids being like,
yeah,
like disturbing behavior.
Yeah. Or even like Children of the Corn, almost in a sense. But like, yeah, I didn't expect it to just like end with him dying. And then now we get to the B story.
Hold on. It doesn't end with him dying. It ends with him dying in the arms of his son,
yeah,
telling him he's sorry for not accepting
that he's
him,
a failure, basically.
And his son saying, "I don't want my dad to die," and then him dying anyway.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Just to lay it out there, you know?
So this is the B story, and Henrik, please take over and explain.
Well, you see, kids, for those uninitiated, the B story and A story in Freddy's Nightmares are a little different than what you may be used to. Instead of them being intertwined, they're split hard in the middle. Because in some areas, Freddy's Nightmares was actually only a half an hour show.
Yeah.
And in other areas, it was a hour long show. So the B story and the A story are pretty much standalone, although they'll have some things related.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're full on continuations, but it's pretty rare. So this B story is a particularly B story.
And it's sadder than the first one, I think, a little bit.
Oh, you just say that because you have a mother and a father.
Oh, my God. All right. So the B story opens with a shot of a back area where we see adults walking around looking into cages that are filled with children who are wearing giant name tags, just like the obsolete sign in the previous story.
Yeah, saying like they're like won't eat cleaner plates, yeah, and stuff like that.
Hates dresses, like, yeah, stuff, yeah, like that.
And I want to mention, my favorite thing about this child adoption place is there are just men stomping around in
bloody aprons.
Blood soaked aprons. Aprons, though, not aprons that are like a little bloody. I mean, like, they're covered in blood.
Yeah, and they're escorting the adults.
So they're like, but they have so much blood on them that it's not like, oh, do you think that like they just beat the? No. Like, this is
dead.
Murder blood. This is murder blood. So I just wanted to mention that full on and get that out here.
So we meet Christina, who's played by Kimberly Cates. So she was in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure in 89. She played Princess Elizabeth, which means we have now had the two princesses on Freddy's Nightmares.
We have the original two.
Yes.
Holy moly. And in the first season.
I know.
Station.
She was also in Chain Heat 2.
Well, who wasn't?
Silk Stockings.
Oh, and the TV show.
And Charmed.
Oh, I love Silk Stockings.
She's clutching a baby doll, begging for her real parents. The guard shows her to a disfigured woman who helps pull her out of the cell, leaving the baby doll behind. We then cut to Freddy automatically, who's just also sporting his own name tag.
Oh, yeah.
And states, "Do you know who your parents are?" Almost childlike, but then, of course, he does sinister laughter afterwards.
And my first thought was, why? What have you heard? Like, my mom, do you know that story about when my mom tried to prank me into thinking I was adopted when I turned 18?
Oh, God, you've never told me this.
Oh, yeah, my mom's hilarious. It's where I get it from. Yeah, my mother, on my 18th birthday or the day after my 18th birthday or something, my mom came to me and said, like, "Since you're 18 now, you have the right to know that you were adopted." And I was like, what? And she was like, you were adopted. And, you know, if you want to find out who your birth parents are, I support you. And I was like, Mom, I look exactly like my dad. No, like you could look at my dad and go, that's his dad.
That's fair.
No, I look a lot. I look exactly like my grandfather did when I was, when he was my age, but like, I look a lot like my dad. So I didn't even believe it, but she like held to it and then left the room saying she'd go get the papers and then came back and just laughed her ass off.
Oh my God. I could see her doing that.
Oh yeah. No, my mom and I used to prank each other so much. I once told her my high school girlfriend was pregnant, scared the ever living crap out of her. That was my revenge for that one. We actually had to call a truce because we kept escalating. Oh my God. Yeah. That's my mom and I.
So we got to Christina, no longer dirty, nor in rags, laying on her bed in her bedroom.
Well, she's still a little dirty.
A little dirty. Her mom enters, nagging at her for sleeping in her clothes. Christina tells her to drop it, stating that she didn't mean to, but she fell asleep while reading. Her mom asks how late she was out last night, stating, it's no wonder people talk. Christina gets up and goes to change, stripping down to her bra and panties.
Yeah, and like, she is very in her bra and panties.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, it is very, I mean, like, I know, but so before we continue with this brilliant scene.
Yes.
Did we see this woman at all in the A story?
I don't think so.
She might have been in the crowd of people in his living room with the like Save Springwood Bank or whatever.
I think she may have been like in the original. Yeah.
But I feel like I'm going insane because I was like, was she in the A story?
Yeah.
But it does reference. She does know someone from the A story.
Yes, she does. So.
So she tells her people think she's a slut, right?
So Christina comments to let them talk. She knows she's not a slut, but her mom continues to lay into her, stating, you never know the way you dress.
Yeah, because, you know, when you wear jeans and T-shirts, people are like, did you see that slut over there? She doesn't even wear sundresses, the whore.
So her mom comments that she bought her a closet full of dresses and skirts, but she continues to wear ratty jeans. Christina tells her that she'll start wearing clothes next week and she's just adjusting.
I love that she says, I'll start wearing clothes.
Yeah, I know.
Next week,
to which you're like,
wait, is she nude at school? Because I guess I can understand people talking then.
Christina tells her that, her mom comments that she just wants her to fit in and hanging out with her outcast friend John isn't helping.
Is it a little late when she's like 17?
I feel like it is.
Like maybe that's like my mom asking me if I want help fitting in now. I'm 36.
Christina argues that her mom doesn't know who she is buying dresses that are three sizes too big and 10 years too late. Her mom states that she wonders sometimes if she's really her daughter before walking off. Christina yells for her mom not to say that, adding she doesn't even look like her and maybe some gypsies left her at the doorstep. We then cut to Springwood High, where Christina meets up with John, who reminds her that she didn't call him last night. Christina starts to complain about her mom earlier comments, which John replies, what are parents for, jokingly. She asks John if he ever feels like he doesn't belong, and John asks if she means that she feels like an alien, and her parents are mutant humanoids from the deep.
Yeah, they reference Humanoids from the Deep. Are you happy?
I'm very happy.
That's one of Louis's favorite films.
Christina explains that she has a fear that maybe she belongs to someone else. John confirms that he knows the feeling before telling Christina that he found out that he was adopted shortly after his father passed.
Which makes it not sad anymore, right?
No,
that wasn't his dad. That was just a guy who cared for him and loved him and paid for everything.
Christina asked why he never mentioned it before, and John states he never felt much like talking about it, and he's even unsure he still wants to now. John goes on to explain he asked his mom about his real parents, but would rather keep it an idealized version instead. Christina asks, how does he know unless he finds out for himself? But John says he's afraid because he might not like what he finds before walking off. Later at home, Christina is first to arrive, confirming this by calling to her mom with no answer. She finds a note from her mom stating there's a PTA meeting till 4 and dinner's in the oven. She looks at the clock, noticing that it's 3:50, and Christina begins to search all over the house for her birth certificate with no luck. She moves to her mother's room, tearing it apart, looking in drawers, closets, and boxes, and she finds a huge box stuffed with papers, but is interrupted as her mother returns, asking, what is she doing in her room? Christina lies that she's looking for a recipe, and her mother questions, in my closet? Next time, try the kitchen.
Boom.
Christina argues she'll clean it up, but her mother argues it's not the issue, stating that she needs to have respect for her things. Christina then gets upset, telling her mom she feels like sometimes she acts like she doesn't even belong to her at all before storming out and falling onto her bed in her room. She closes her eyes and drifts off to sleep, coming back to in one of the cages at the orphanage.
And I don't know, man. I'm starting to think that they dirty up these children for aesthetic purposes, like just to make the adopters feel bad.
I was waiting for Freddy to be walking around looking at the kid.
Walking around with a leash. He's swinging around like, which one today?
A pipe.
Yeah, just a striped pipe.
Has a punch card.
This is my 15th. It should be free.
So a woman shows her mother, Christina, as Christina comment or as the mother comments she's cute before asking how much. The woman then hands her a clipboard and the mother comments that it states Christina's parents were taken away and she still needs her shots. But she agrees to take her anyway, signing the clipboard.
I mean, that's how we became friends. Even though you needed her shots, I was like, you know what? It's worth the investment.
That's fair.
As long as I get to put you down.
I mean, you know,
inevitably, very soon.
Christina fights, stating that she's waiting for her real parents, but she's interrupted as John begins to cry out as two men in the butcher's aprons carry him off, begging. The door shuts on a room, revealing a sign "recalled" on it as he pleads to stop. And the pleas are then replaced by stabbing sounds as a puddle of blood begins to spread under the door. This episode is really bloody.
It is extremely, extremely bloody. I mean, this place is dark, even by human trafficking standards.
That's very true. Like,
holy crap.
Like, when we say cages, they're chain link fences that are just, like, put up in the center of the rooms and on the sides.
It's like, you would be mad if they kept dogs in those.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is.
Well, a great example is, remember the movie I showed you guys a while back with Gene Hackman and Lee Marvin called Prime Cut? And there's that scene where we introduce Hackman's character and, like, Sissy Spacek is in that, like, pen with all those naked chicks and they're touring
Yes,
them.
I remember Prime Cut.
Prime
it's
Cut's
a
really,
really
good.
Great messed up movie.
Oh my God, it's so good.
If you like watching animals get slaughtered in the beginning, I highly recommend it.
You know, Christina wakes up on her bed and picks up the phone, dialing John. A female voice on the other end tells her that John doesn't live there, and Christina apologizes, thinking that she has the wrong number. She walks over to her mirror, but stops, realizing that written in blood on her shirt, it now says adopted. She closes her eyes and takes a second, opening them again to reveal that nothing is on her shirt anymore. Later at school, Christina is walking into class and sits down at her desk. The desk next to her is empty till a young woman sits, but Christina tries to politely tell her, "That's John's seat." But the woman ignores her.
She doesn't just ignore her. She looks like she doesn't speak English.
That's true, too.
She just, like, just kind of looks at her blankly.
And just turns away.
And then turns away and never gets up or says anything.
The teacher begins to call attendance, including Christina's. Later, the bell sounds, dismissing the class as Christina approaches the teacher, asking why she didn't call John's name in attendance. Confused, the teacher asks, "Who?" And Christina repeats his name. The teacher replies that name isn't on here, but Christina argues that it has to be because he's her friend, which I love that. It's like, well, he has to be. He's my friend.
He's my friend. Yeah, yeah. That doesn't make you sound insane.
The teacher eerily replies, "Not anymore."
Ooh.
Christina argues he's been in school for 4 years and she has to remember him. The teacher tells her that she doesn't know a John, and if Christina doesn't stop bothering her, maybe they'll have to have her recalled. Christina slowly backs away and leaves the classroom. At home, Christina and her mom sit having spaghetti. Her mom looks at her concerned, but Christina breaks the silence, asking if she has her birth certificate, lying that she needs it for show and tell at school tomorrow.
What, you don't show and tell your birth certificate?
I don't have show and tell in high school.
I would be pretty mad because, to be honest, if I was in show and tell in high school or middle school,
yeah,
and they were like, "Hey, show your birth certificate," I'd be like, "Okay, first of all, I'm the only Hispanic one in this room." So I don't know that I appreciate this.
That's fair. That's very fair.
Hashtag get a warrant essay.
So lies that she needs it for show and tell tomorrow. Her mother replies that she'll write the information down later tonight, but Christina tells her she needs the real thing. Her mother interrupts that they lost the records and it's very unfortunate accident, which prompts Christina to ask, "What accident?" Her mother replies that their house caught fire and destroyed them, and Christina asks about the hospital she was born at, having a copy. Her mother tells her that they didn't have her in a hospital and that her and Christina's father wanted a natural birth at home, adding, "It's a shame he's not around anymore to see how much she's grown." Christina asks, why does she continue playing games and what does she have to hide?
Now, before we get to that,
yeah,
could you imagine getting a new birth certificate in Springwood?
Oh God.
If the office was the same office that issued death certificates,
you know, shit.
They'd be like, there is a 6 to 18 year wait.
It's going to get to the point where they're just crossing out death and writing birth.
Yeah, they're just writing birth on. They're like, sorry, we ran out of the other ones, but we never run out of the death ones.
We never have the death ones. Always on hand.
We have plenty of those.
So she asks her mother why she's always playing games. What does she have to hide? Her mother responds with Inka Dinka Slinky Fondin Twinka.
I can't believe you actually wrote this.
Oh, I wrote them. That's so good. Puzzled Christina responds with, excuse me? As her mother adds, Smeedy Tana Wana Ducka Fakfa.
And I felt like I had a stroke.
Yeah. Christina tells her that she's leaving, or that she's had it, leaving the table, adding, it's obvious we don't even speak the same language. Later that night, Christina searches the kitchen for more documents, which, let me stop for a second. Did you notice how all the lights were on and she has a flashlight while she's looking in the cupboards?
Well, she's being thorough.
Yes, that's exactly Louis. What it is.
She's being thorough.
So she finds an envelope in a cupboard, opening it to find a paper that says Springwood Adoption Center for Catherine Young with the address of 143 Elm Street.
And it was hidden.
Yes, it was.
Where no one would ever find it. Behind the oats.
Behind the oats, indeed. She comments she's secondhand and runs off with the document. We then see Christina inside the Springwood Adoption Center as she goes into a room that's marked children. Inside, she finds the room exactly like her dreams with all the kids in cages. The sales lady, played by Jacqueline Devalhan, has two men grab her, commenting that one of their own has returned and ask her what she wants, adding, no refunds.
I like they say no refunds to her. It's like, well, you're not going to refund her. She didn't pay for herself begin with. But anyway,
Christina tells her she's looking for her real parents, but the sales lady tells her there's only one, her real mother, before handing Christina a paper with the address asking if this is what she really wants. Christina tells her it is, and the sales lady laughs as they release, telling her, be my guest. We next see Christina approaching the exterior of Freddy's house.
And she's going to get turned away for being too old.
No, thank you.
Oh, no. How old? 17? Oh, God. Oh, I'm gagging.
As she enters to find her real mother sitting at a table smoking. And the table, mind you, looks like a fucking, like, voodoo hut table out of Serpent and the Rainbow.
It does. No, it absolutely does.
The woman confirms that she's Christina's real mom. And for the record, it's the actress that does play her mom. She's just completely, like,
she's made up to look like a barfly. Yeah. Like 25 years past her prime.
She's Christina's real mom, commenting she turned out every as bit as ugly as she thought she would.
Which is sweet.
Glad I gave you away. Christina questions how is this possible, and her mother goes to add that she's spoiling the reunion. She's got some men coming over later for the real party, adding she's probably got some of her mom's talents, as she sticks her tongue out provocatively. Aww, at Christina.
Wholesome content! Wholesome content! Wholesome content! Wholesome content! Wholesome content! Wholesome content!
Christina asks her if she's her real mother, then who's her father? Her mother comments that he had a lot of women, but bad taste in clothes. Always wore the same sweater all the time. Nice hat, though. His name was Freddy.
It was Freddy, not bitch. Sorry.
Bitch. Christina begins to freak out as her mother gets a demon voice stating, welcome home.
So did Freddy's dead just steal all the best stuff from Freddy's nightmares?
That's this, what I'm kind of picking up on.
Multiple times we've noticed that things that happened in Freddy's nightmares are straight into Freddy's dead.
100%.
Which hadn't happened yet.
No. It had not. So we come back and find Christina dirty, head to toe, standing over a boiling pot of gruel. She is now dressed in one of the dresses from the beginning that her mom pointed out in the closet, as her mom sits at the table ordering out more food as she begins to, like, have gruel come out of her mouth.
So now, would you call that gruel? I would call it slop.
Slop? Yeah, slop. That's fair.
But maybe that's a territory. Like, did you call them tennis shoes or sneakers when you were a kid?
Sneakers.
See, it must be, I called them tennis shoes. Yeah. So see, that's why it's slop versus gruel. Okay, we got through that pretty comfortably.
Christina takes the pot to the table and begins to dish out more before her mother orders her to go feed the other misfits. We then see Christina begin to dish out more slop to a group of kids, also filthy, head to toe in a line. They begin to chant, one of us, one of us, one of us, repeatedly. Christina then cries out that she wants to go home and wants her old life back before breaking down crying. Suddenly, John appears in front of her, taking her hands and startling her. John comments that he's her friend, remember? Relieved to see him, she asks him to help her out of here. He takes her hand, leading her up the steps as she picks up her, up the steps as she picks at her adopted sash draped over her. John tells her it'll never come off as she's stained for life just like him. They make their way to the door, but open it to find the mother and more children on the other side as they all rush in. Her mother shoves John out, closing the door, and tells Christina this is her home. She's a misfit and she belongs with them, yeah. And nobody else will have her.
And that's true. I mean, Christina's, remember that, kids.
Christina suddenly wakes up back in her room on her bed. She begins to repeat, oh, thank you, as she's relieved it was only a dream. She goes to the closet, pulling out one of the dresses, commenting that she's even happy to see these stupid things, and she'll wear it to make her mom happy. Aww. She puts on the dress and makes her way down to the kitchen where her mom sits at the table and comments that the dress makes her look more like her daughter now. Christina sits at the table as her mom attends to a pot on the stove, and Christina asks her mom if she's her daughter, and that if she wasn't, she'd tell her, right? Her mom turns around, stating, of course, dear. Christina adds that she feels strange and sometimes like a misfit. Her mom comments, oh, you'll get used to that, which causes Christina to ask, used to what? I'm not a misfit. Her mom turns back around and replies, of course, dear, before turning back again. Christina goes on to apologize, stating that she found out John moved away and he just found out that he was adopted, so maybe he was taken away by his real parents. She adds that she misses him before adding if she missed her, she would miss her if she was taken away. Her mother suddenly turns to reveal the disfigured woman from the opening story who tells her, welcome home to stay forever and ever. Christina runs off downstairs, going over to a furnace with flames burning inside of it.
Furnace.
Yes.
Gargantuan furnace.
And opens the door. Her mother comes down the stairs laughing maniacally as she searches, calling her a misfit child. Her mother then stops in front of the furnace as Christina hits her in the back with a shovel.
Hansel and Gretel that shit.
Knocking her down and shoving her into the fire.
And now Wes Craven is stealing from Freddy's nightmares for a new nightmare.
Christina watches from behind as her mother screams in pain before shutting the doors. She locks them and turns around, stating, you're not my mother. You never were, and now you never will be.
Yeah, because you burned to death.
Suddenly, we see Christina chewing on her lips as a woman calls to her, telling her that she wants her to come meet her new foster parents. The social worker, who was the saleswoman from her dream, tells another woman it's been a really hard time on Christina, revealing that her mother died in an accidental fire, destroying their home, leaving her with no relatives, so now she can't accept the idea of a foster home. We then cut to Christina's POV as the social worker and the foster mom are both suddenly deformed and burned, speaking in gibberish like her mother was previously in the episode. Christina bites her lips and continuously comments she's waiting for her real mommy as the two get up, leaving her to repeat it.
Yeah, and that, you know, isn't the darkest fucking ending ever. Like, I'm gonna sleep great tonight.
Yeah.
For sure. Jesus.
Episode ends as we cut to Freddy, who is in his domain with three dead teens on display, one with a sign that says trade-in, one that says corrected, and one that says used parts. Freddy states, come on down! Worried about your credit? I ain't. We've got every shape, every size, every price. I'll make you a deal you can't refuse.
I even take trade-ins.
And that, my friends, is season 1, episode 21, Identity Crisis.
And what an ending was. And,
uh-oh. Oh, we were almost out.
I was almost out.
Hey, bitch.
Hey, Freddy.
How you kids doing? It doesn't matter how you're doing. I heard The Rock say that once.
I bet you did.
Freddy, are you eating?
One second.
That's not a Chipotle burrito, is it?
No, it's a hothead burrito.
Oh, he's got
Springwood's in Ohio, you know.
He's right.
That's a fair point.
Fair point.
And they would have to have a hothead burrito. Did you guys get a Sheetz yet?
Not yet.
It's coming.
It's got to be. It's got to be. Just stay positive, Fred.
Yeah, thanks. Anyway, how about that girl at the end, right? No parents, no problem. I love finding people who are destroyed emotionally.
Jesus, Freddy.
It's not okay.
I can't even with
you. Okay. Don't mind me. I was just kidding around.
Okay.
Oh, I guess I should really adopt more tact.
He's really proud of that one.
Yeah. Well, so Freddy, what about this claim that you have like a bunch of children because you were sleeping around a lot? Like, I want to know about that. Like,
yeah, let's
hear it. Were you like not only pretty much like raping and murdering children, but also like just like slinking around town like a tomcat.
Nick Canning it.
Yeah. Nick Canning it.
None of those kids were mine, by the way.
Oh.
You know my motto. No glove, no love. Freddy away.
I got to give him that one.
That was solid.
I hate it, but I got to give him that one.
Okay, so, well, thanks. Where did he? Oh, he's just standing on the other side of the room.
I don't know what he's doing.
Okay, I'll go.
Bye, Freddy.
Bye, Freddy.
Okay, so let's get a rating in on this.
All right, so Freddy's interactions in this are pretty interesting, to say the least.
He explodes in a microwave.
Yes, he does. So that easily, yeah, that's a hugely passing grade. I don't dislike this episode, but like I you and I talked a little bit off mic. It has a lot cooking for it, but I feel like it doesn't ever get to that boil.
I don't know. I mean, if the boil you're referring to is her whole family I at mean, the end of the movie. Yeah.
It's very sad.
Yeah.
On both stories. And, you know, they're well written, I would say. I mean, the dialogue was really snappy in this, I thought. And overall, they definitely had not a lot drawn out.
They're like, both those classic kind of stories where Freddy's terrorizing you after you've already died, yeah. Basically, which is similar to like the Beefy Boy episode, yes. And stuff where it's like, oh, like I loved in the A story, what, you know, how the wound kept bleeding again, yeah. And again, because that made it clear, like, it's what's really happening.
Stuck in limbo.
It kind of reminded me of what people would do later with those movies. You know, that trope that became a trope where the people were actually dead because they would end up getting injured the way they had actually gotten injured, like in a car accident or whatever.
Exactly.
I like how I almost said what movies do that. And I was like, oh yeah, that's the twist at the end. I almost said
one of the biggest ones. Yeah, too, yeah. So don't worry.
So I liked that. And the whole, I feel like I'm adopted thing, while extremely juvenile, I thought was really funny. I mean, and when I say extremely juvenile, I mean the concept of like, I'm just adopted is just super juvenile.
Yeah. And
but,
I think,
I liked it.
I think what may have just mainly turned me off about the B story in particular was just it was scary, but it wasn't to that level. Like it was more a mental nightmare, like just trying to figure out everything that was going on.
You're having a mental nightmare. So
I'm going to give this a solid C right in the middle.
Solid C?
Solid C.
I'm going to, I hate to agree with you. No, I'm going to give it a C+ because I did like it a little bit more than you. I thought that it had a lot to enjoy and a lot to chuckle at and a lot to be mortified by, because you'd be like, ha 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 ha. And it'd be like, her family died in a fire and now she just mutters to herself. Yeah. And you're like, oh. Thanks.
It's as cold an ending as Black Tickets was, when she completely reverts back to her age.
Yeah. Black Tickets is another one. So, Double D, before we get out of here, what do we have next week as we conclude
season one?
So
we have, of course, Save the Best for Last, because this is one of the most notorious episodes because it's had a lot of it cut out of it. We are talking the final episode of season one, episode 22, Safe Sex. And also, I'm sure this is no surprise, the last Freddy-centric episode of season one.
Well, it's the last episode of season one.
Yes.
And we might be doing an extra episode after that about the uncut version that we might have somehow found. But now we got to get out of here. So until next time, my friends, thank you so much for listening to Welcome to Primetime, a Freddy's Nightmares podcast. I have been your host, Enrique Couto, with my good buddy, Louis DeNoyer.
Hello.
If you want to reach out and cut someone, you can email us at freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com. You can find out everything you'd ever want to know about the show at freddysnightmares.com. Please make sure to like, share, subscribe, leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app. It really does help. We only have like 8 reviews on there. Come on, guys. Yeah, I know there are 9 of you. Get out there. Do something. But until next time, we will tell you to have a sweet dreams.
Pleasant dreams.
Oh, I said sweet, you said pleasant. I'm muting you forever.